This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Wednesday, October 28th, 2015. I'm Caleb Brown. The internal culture of megabanks drove many of the decisions that led to the financial crisis. Edward Kane, a professor of finance at Boston College, argues that the implicit guarantee of a taxpayer-funded bailout needs to carry a price along with it. Until then, he argues, the structure of high finance in the United States will be doomed to repeated crises. What has been the culture of megabanks?
I believe the culture is one of profit maximization, but the unfortunate thing is that the profits do not include the subsidies, or the profits do include the subsidies that they can extract from taxpayers by taking extreme and reckless risks. And then that feeds into the culture of regulators, which is to rescue them. And we're talking about the very biggest banks, the ones that have to be rescued, the ones that are called too big to fail.
So it has a lot to do with what the expectation within the bank is, given the kinds of risks that they're going to take,
or that's
that
right.
Or that they could be induced to accept.
Mm-hmm. Well, I liken it to reckless driving, that if you see sometimes driving here in the city especially, you will see people weaving in and out of lanes at very high speed, and they're causing a lot of danger to other people. They're very confident that they will survive, but you know, at some point you see them, you pass by them a couple blocks later, and they're in a crash. And in traffic, we've set up a system of laws and points and punishments that help to teach people not to drive that way.
And regulators, when they're engaged in their jobs, it's not necessarily clear that regulations that have been put in place are going to have the result that regulators intend. So how have, in your studies, how have regulations impacted the culture of these large financial institutions?
Well, I think it's a culture of predation, that they don't accept the idea that they should behave prudently if it's profitable to take some extreme risks. Just like a teenager learning to drive, the thrill, actually, of taking the risks and getting somewhere faster, beating all your friends to, say, wherever you're going, if you're going to the beach or something. And that we reward people for accounting profits, which include these subsidies. So the big banks, the quickest way to profits is to find ways to avoid the laws, to evade the laws in some cases, invent new instruments that aren't covered by the regulations yet, and take the notion that if it's legal, we can do it.
In the two books about Enron, the two big books, Conspiracy of Fools and The Smartest Guys in the Room, there is talk about one specific regulatory change, which was mark-to-market accounting, that allowed them to book profits on deals that many of which never ultimately came to fruition. What do we take? What should regulators take from that experience with Enron, with Arthur Andersen, that had its own scandal associated with Enron, when it comes to understanding the culture that exists within megabanks?
Well, it's important to understand it's a culture that exists within accounting, that mark-to-market is a very sensible idea, but all of the accounting has enough loopholes that the accountants can make the clients happy. And we have in regulation, especially as we're in crises, is a culture of deception, helping people to hide losses. I did a lot of studying of the S&L mess, and the regulators invented a new kind of accounting they called regulatory accounting principles, and I called it crap because the C was just silent, and the whole idea was to help them hide losses, not recognize that the mortgages had been driven down in value, that the S&Ls owned by the increase in interest rates and the inflation going on, and starting with the Vietnam War and continuing until Volcker came in and broke the back of inflation eventually. But almost all the S&Ls of this country were insolvent, and they invented ways to help them not to mark those assets down and pass the guaranteed losses on to the taxpayer who made good on all the deposits that these people raised.
All right. So taxpayers making good on promises, is that ultimately the problem when it comes to financial institutions taking excessive risks? Is that implicit guarantee, is that ultimately the problem?
Well, it's the way in which the guarantee is exercised. You know, all guarantees have two parts to them. What we call the put, to be able to put the losses to the guarantor. But the guarantor has a stop-loss right, a right to take over the assets. And that's what is an exercise, the idea of rescuing all the creditors of an institution that is taking substantial risk. And many of the creditors know that they're taking these risks. And they're gambling right alongside the institutions or the managers of the institutions, that that the institutions will be saved, they'll be saved, and they'll force taxpayers, coerce taxpayers to pick up the bills.
What of this designation that has existed and still exists, even under Dodd-Frank, that there are some institutions that are too big to fail? It seems almost like, and I have had this discussion with several different folks, it's almost like countries that have nuclear weapons and don't have nuclear weapons. And when you observe the United States dealing with countries that don't have nuclear weapons, the treatment is quite often very different, it seems, than when we talk to countries that do have nuclear weapons. So are financial institutions strongly encouraged to gain that designation somehow?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, that if you look around and see that other countries are treated better because they have nuclear weapons, then that encourages you to get them. So institutions want to be difficult to fail, and it isn't really just like a light switch that you either on or off, but the closer, the bigger you get, the more complicated you get, the more politically connected you get across the Congress, the harder it's going to be, and I would say rather than fail, but to unwind, to close and unwind. And so these institutions just scare regulators, and regulators feel a duty to rescue them, and they understand that, and they reinforce the duty. If you read the books about this crisis, they're always talking about these meetings where the heads of institutions came down and scared Geithner and scared before him Paulson, and certainly scared Ben Bernanke into thinking that if they didn't put up all this money from taxpayers, things would go completely bananas. But in fact, it was the way they did it that I feel was wrong, ethically wrong, that the duties to taxpayers weren't really followed. This was just a massive rescue of everybody, people who knew the risks they were taking and were making money from having taken those risks. And now it was coming home, and they didn't want the losses, and they had the political power and the persuasive power to scare the regulators and saying they had to be rescued, and they had to be rescued completely. If you read Geithner's book, I find it disgusting, the idea that we couldn't have any creditor take any losses. That's a terrible incentives for the future. And that's why I think we'll have another crisis before too long.
So when you talk about preventing creditors from taking losses, this is the standard process in almost every other kind of investment where you provide capital, you assess the quality of the institution that is going to be making use of that capital, and you assume the risk of that investment.
That's right. I own a few stocks, and one of my firms reported a big fall off in earnings, and it lost a third of its value last week. Well, that's fair. You know, I didn't know. I didn't say on top of it. I presume if I'd really been studying that, I could have seen it and got out ahead of it. But, you know, that's as you say, that's the rules of the game. Whatever sport you play, you have to expect some pain from that sport.
In terms of if we understand that regulations often don't have the intended result, if we understand that there's a strong incentive by people who work for either the Department of the Treasury or the Federal Reserve to not look bad ultimately when making a decision whether or not to let a firm fail on its own or get close to failure, how do you then credibly reorient these subcultures within banks that have taken these enormous risks?
Well, we have to change the responsibility of everybody involved. And I think we actually need to change training programs and regulators to get across the fact that they're going to face these enormous political pressures, that crises will develop, and they've got to understand they have a duty to taxpayers. But most importantly, we have to go in and recognize that taxpayers are disadvantaged minority investors in any bank that's too big to fail, and that their position needs to be measured and needs to be protected by the law, so that there has to be a duty from the manager, say, of Chase to taxpayers to pay them a dividend on the value of their guarantee quarter by quarter. And
so balancing essentially the put option,
that's right,
with some sort of cash benefit for what are quote-unquote guarantors, the taxpayers.
Yes, we seem to believe in the price system, but not here, you see. And think of a taxpayer's position. They can't, as compared to the ordinary stock in, say, Chase, the taxpayer cannot sell his position. He's stuck with it. That the losses are unlimited, but the gains are, because if the firm's doing very well, then there is the benefit is only of getting out of from underwater in the guarantee. Once that happens, that's pretty much the top of what you can get. And then they can make things very much worse for you by delaying the recognition of losses, by putting off regulatory adjustments that would rebuild their capital. So it's a very disadvantaged position.
So in some sense, this is what you're suggesting then is to assign a price to the option of putting losses onto taxpayers. But that's just really an insurance policy,
no,
right?
No, no. Oh, no.
No?
No, that's very important. That I think part of what keeps the too big to fail alive is mischaracterizing the nature of the bailout. What kind of insurance policy, what kind of insurance company would give coverage to money market mutual funds when they're insolvent, when they need it? They didn't pay anything for the insurance before they got it. It was given to them. They paid a little bit during that period. Then it's they were incentivized.
Oh, so this is an after-the-fact payment rather than a
Well, no, I'm saying what we have, we call that bailout is somehow some implicit insurance. It's not implicit insurance. It's implicit loss-absorbing equity.
Okay.
And it's certainly not a loan. You see, what I'm saying is that these guarantees, to treat them as a form of insurance is to confuse the way people think about it.
Okay.
Because in insurance law, we recognize the concept of moral hazard. You insure people, and then you as an insurance company are supposed to control the losses. Well, the trouble with finance is that people can have a million ways to take losses. And so you've got to make them responsible to taxpayers to actually bring incentives under control. Because if you just put some more incentives, like a little bit higher capital requirements, some new liquidity requirements, requirements to take stress tests, all of these things still leave in place that you have the right to do your activity in such a way that it walks around the laws. Circumvents the laws.
What's so bad about standard bankruptcy court for even these very large institutions?
Well, there are a lot of us that say that something like the bankruptcy process is way better than not failing them at all. But it still is the question that in a crisis, once you get in a crisis, the culture of rescue is so strong in the financial regulatory sector that that's what you're going to get. But we notice that we don't punish any individuals for taking these reckless risks. There has been, as far as I know, no top banking executive go to jail. Most of the fines go to the company, which means the stockholders who weren't in position to see the losses because they were being hidden by this kind of accounting you talked about at the beginning. So we have to put new responsibilities on the executives. Now, British law has started to move in that direction, but just backed off last week. And it's very disappointing, but at least they saw that this would be very helpful, that people that they had a law that said that if you were in a position to take a risk that was ruinous, you took that risk, and you knowingly took that risk, knowing that it could render the thing the insolvent, and that the standards with which you evaluated all this were way below what should be the standards in banking. That's going to be where it would be hard to prosecute. But even that, that was characterized as reversing the burden of proof, and the new British government changed it. Said that they were going to go back just to treat regulatory breaches. And I'm saying that's the whole problem. They say, if we write a regulation and you breach it, we can punish you or punish your bank. But if you find a way around that regulation so you're not really breaching it, well, that's okay, you know?
How different is this from Badgett's rule? That is, I mean, the idea that you have this collateral that's good collateral. I mean, we never really established that in the financial crisis. But how different is what you're suggesting from Badgett's rule?
Well, Badgett's rule is a rule about when you rescue and when you don't. What I'm saying is that as long as we have incentives in the industry that says it's okay to steal money from taxpayers as long as you don't break the law. And we're going to – the law is not going to be actually passed in a way creating responsibility. It's just going to say, here's rule one, here's rule two, here's rule three, here's rule four. And if you can manage to break the spirit of that law without breaking the letter of the law, you're home free. And that's what – it's that's unacceptable. You know, if somebody invented a new way of robbing people on the street – and somehow walked through the laws, we would still feel that they should be punished for that, and we would immediately change the laws. But here the nice thing is that the street robbers don't have a lobbying force, whereas these very big banks have extremely strong lobbying force and give lots of money to politicians that lead them to be sympathetic to their problems when they get into trouble.
Edward Kane is a professor of finance at Boston College. Download the new Cato Audio app for your iOS device and get access to all six Cato Institute podcasts. Learn more at cato.org.